Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn, and you're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Wednesday, the 13th of October. I'm very excited about this hour. I once had a dream. I wish I would have it night after night, but I had a dream some years ago where I was sitting on a cloud with Bob Dylan, and we sang all of his songs. And I don't know the words to all of his songs, but I remembered every single word, and I woke up and was just so darned happy. Our guest this hour has been going to Bob Dylan concerts and writing liner notes for his album and looking at his place in history, which is an important thing. This is a very important singer. Bob Dylan and lyricist. Bob Dylan America is the name of Sean Wilentz's book. Sean is a Sidney and Ruth Lapidus professor in the American Revolutionary Era at Princeton University. He's the author of The Rise of American Democracy, and most recently of The Age of Reagan. He is, how's this for a job title, the historian in residence for Bob Dylan's official website. And he's also received an award for musical commentary and a Grammy nomination. And he was disappointed he didn't win, let's be honest, for his liner notes to Bootleg Series Volume 6, Bob Dylan Live 1964, the concert at Philharmonic Hall. We're going to have a great hour, and you can't talk about Dylan without listening to Dylan, so we will do that momentarily. This is, of course, also our Wisconsin Public Radio fall membership drive. Rhonda Fanning is joining me in our studios in Milwaukee. 3 minutes of your time, we ask you for that to make a pledge, a gift to WPR.org or 888-202-2552. Hi, Rhonda.
Hi, Kathleen. I just wanted to mention that our goal last hour was 50 pledges, and we heard from 78 of you, 68 of you. So I wanted to thank everyone who pledged last hour.
That's great.
But our goal this hour is another 50 pledges, so we need to hear from another 50 of you before 11 o'clock. And meeting this goal helps make sure that Wisconsin Public Radio has the money we need to fund the programming that you rely on here on WPR each and every day. So please give now at WPR.org or call 888-202-2552.
In just a moment, Sean Wilentz will be joining us. His book has been getting rave reviews. The book is Bob Dylan in America, and you can get Sean's book for your pledge this hour. How's this for a whole month worth of activity? You read Sean's book, and then you play the music that he's referencing. So you're listening to Dylan, and you're reading Sean's book, and you know, it doesn't get much better than that, if you like Bob Dylan, of course, and many of you do. The important thing is to make a gift. If you could do $180, we'll send you the book, and you do this right now at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
Giving at WPR.org or 888-202-2552 is easy. All it takes is a gift of a dollar or two a week and a few minutes of your time. A dollar or two a week adds up to about $50 or $100 for the entire year, and all year long, you're going to benefit from this program and other programs on WPR, Joy Cardine and Ben Marins, Larry Mueller, Car Talk. The list goes on. All of the WPR programs that you love. Make your contribution now at WPR.org or 888-202-2552 and give as generously as you can.
I love this comment that WPR, this is from Barbara from Burlington, has been a good and wise friend during many long hours of traveling. A wise friend, that's a nice description. Again, for a pledge of $180, we're going to send you Bob Dylan in America, the book we're discussing this hour, Sean Wilentz, and it's a wonderful book. It's very thorough. It looks not only at Dylan, but it also looks at earlier influences on Dylan. And that includes people like Aaron Copland, so, and of course, Woody Guthrie and others. You're going to love this conversation and love listening to music. Please pledge now. Give your gift at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
Yes, help us reach that goal of 50 pledges this hour. And at that $100.80 level, you're going to receive a copy of Sean Wilentz's book. And you'll also be entered to win that iPad that is just, the drawing is happening today. Anyone who pledges today.
Thanks very much, Rhonda. Sean Wilentz is our guest now here on the Ideas Network. His book is Bob Dylan in America. And Sean has a really interesting life. He is, as I said, a professor in the American Revolutionary Era at Princeton, author of The Rise of American Democracy, and also The Age of Reagan. He is the historian in residence for Bob Dylan's official website, and he's received a Grammy nomination. We'll be sure and ask him about that during this hour. We'd like to see he was the Grammy winner, but maybe that is yet to come for his liner notes to Bootleg Series Volume 6. He heard Bob Dylan when he was very young, and he has an interesting story to tell about hearing him at the Philharmonic. Sean Wilentz, thank you so much for being with us.
It's a delight. Thanks for
Yeah, it's great to have you here. I've been singing, for some reason, Mr. Tambourine Man all morning long. I love that song, but now I can't get it out of my head.
That happens with Dylan's song sometimes, yeah.
Yeah, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, you know, they get in your head, and you're wondering, well, why am I singing this for the 1,500th time?
Yeah. But you're glad to be singing it because there's a lot of meat in what you're singing usually, isn't there? You're singing it, and it's a message. You, it's because of how you grew up, isn't life interesting, and who your father was and the bookstore and all of that, that you got to hear Dylan when you were, I believe, 13 years old.
Right.
And there you go.
Yeah, well, it was, you know, completely a matter of luck. I mean, my dad and his brother owned a bookshop in Greenwich Village on the corner of 8th Street and McDougal, which was, you know, the shop itself was a kind of literary, downtown literary crossroads. You know, the beat poets, but also just the whole range of writers in and around New York City in the 1950s and 1960s, which was a very exciting time to be that, to be there.
Sure.
Purely from a literary standpoint. But this down the block, or down McDougal Street, were all of the folk clubs, the folklore center that I write about in the book, the Gaslight Cafe, the Cafe Wow, all of that, where the folk revival was starting and where Bob Dylan was getting his start in 1961, 62. And those two worlds kind of converged at various points. So, you know, I'm growing up in all of that, and it's, you know, the only downside, Kathleen, is I thought this was normal. I thought this is what the world is like. But actually, yes, but I also knew it was kind of special, too. I mean, it was an exciting time. Lots was going on, quite apart from music and literature. There was theater, and there were movies coming out. The latest Truffaut would hit town, and everybody would be very excited. So, you know, it was quite a time.
Right. And you got to, were you 13 years old when you went to the Philharmonic?
Yeah. I was in 1964, October 31st, Halloween, in 1964, and this is also a problem with growing up in this world. It's very hard to be a rebel as a young teenager, you know, when your dad is scoring you tickets to
Bob Dylan.
Yeah, right. A couple of years later, he gave me my first copy of Blonde on Blonde.
Oh, my gosh.
So here, go listen to this. I thought maybe that's why I ended up a Princeton professor, you know, I mean, kind of, you know, off to the side. But, it was a wonderful concert. I'd already certainly heard about Bob Dylan, listened to some of his music. I was already something of a fan. And it was held at Philharmonic Hall, now Avery Fisher Hall, in the brand new Lincoln Center for the Performing Arts, which was, you know, the great showcase, meant to be, and it was quickly turning into the great showcase of certainly New York and really American high musical performance. The Metropolitan Opera was soon to open there, and others. So here's Bob Dylan, this downtown folk singer, who's going to be, you know, performing in this citadel, the culture, high culture. And well, you know, we all streamed out of the subway. You know, the downtown beatnik, Bam the Bomb, civil rights youth, and we went into the hall, and a guy came out and told us to not, you know, there would be no smoking. And out came Bob Dylan, the first time I'd ever laid eyes on him, really, that I know about anyway. And, you know, he just started playing The Times They Are Changing, and the place went nuts.
he was 23, is that right?
He was 23, 1941, yeah, he was 23. He was. It is remarkable to think back and realize how young he really was when all that was happening.
Right.
But he also played some songs. He's played some of his older songs, then older, 2 years old, but from more familiar songs. Some of his political songs, some of his you know, early love songs, but he also played new material, and he'd always put in new material in his concerts in this period. And so he played Gates of Eden, and he played It's All Right, Mom, Only Bleeding, and he played Mr. Tambourine Man. And these were songs that had not only never been recorded, and not yet been recorded, but you know, some people had heard Mr. Tambourine Man over the summer at the Newport Folk Festival, and so they applauded very loudly when he played that.
Mm-hmm.
But the rest of them, I mean, no one knew what they were. I mean, he had just started playing them in concerts on the road, and they just blew us away. They blew me away. I mean, in the sense that I really couldn't understand what was in there, but there was a lot in there, and so you were trying to grasp every line, and you couldn't put the needle back on the record at that point to try and understand exactly what the line was. But it was a great evening. Joan Baez came out during the second half, and they sang a duet some duets together, and it was an amazing concert.
Yeah. You have some wonderful pictures in the book, including a great outfit that Joan Baez was wearing with these fishnet stockings and some kind of hat and Dylan's pants.
Yeah.
You can see the crease.
Yeah,
you can see it's all pressed.
Well, back in those days, that's what it was to be hip. He had brown suede boots on, light brown suede boots, pressed slacks, and a kind of short suede jacket, but his hair kind of gave him away. His hair was kind of, I don't know, Elvis Presley style. It was a little wild.
You talk about his strongest work, and I would agree that his strongest work was early. Maybe it's just me that I was young in those days, and I listened to him a whole lot, and that work resonated with me.
Right.
But even at the age of 23, his strong work, and you talk about his strongest work, mixing tradition and utterly original material, and he always has that, even at 23.
Mm-hmm.
He's got tradition down like you wouldn't believe it, and we're talking Copeland, we're talking centuries before that. He really understands music, doesn't he? And and folk.
Yeah. Well, you know, he had gone through a number of styles. He was a, you know, normal kid out in the, well, I know nothing about Bob Dylan was probably ever normal,
right.
But he was a kid out in Hibbing, Minnesota, playing rock and roll, playing Little Richard in his high school auditorium, and having the curtain drawn on him because people thought it was too raucous and too wild. But then he got into the folk music of Woody Guthrie. You know, Dylan has said that he can listen to a song once and just have it down pat, not only lyrically but the musical structure. He just has this ability to do it. And it's certainly believable because when he immerses himself in something, he possesses it in a way. He enters it. He makes it his own. And he was able to do that in the folk tradition. There were many other folk singers around, very talented folk singers, very sharp. But he had an ability to not only know the entire range of that music and to enter it, but also, as you were saying, Kathleen, he turned it into something new, turned it into something his own. And add to that a literary sensibility, which had been nurtured by his teachers, actually, in Hibbing, but that was really quite remarkable, and he was able to fuse the two so that, you know, in very early songs, well, fairly early songs, like Boots of Spanish Leather, that's a love song, a song of longing, he takes a song that, you know, the kind of song that's normally sung by a woman to a man, about the man taking off and leaving, and she's left behind pining for this, you know, wandering wastrel. It's the other way around. It's the woman's the one who's leaving and he's left behind. And it switches, turns everything around. And sometimes you're not quite sure who's singing what. He has an ability to keep you on your toes, as it were, and to have to think about, well, what is this song really saying? And once you get to that place, it's really quite moving very often.
Very moving. He's very moving. Bob Dylan in America is the name of Sean's book. Sean Wilentz is our guest this hour, and we're delighted to have him with us. The book's been getting rave reviews, and Sean has a very interesting background. Well, he's a guy of many, many talents himself. This is from the 1964 concert that Sean Wilentz went to that he just described.
I stumbled on the sides of 12 misty mountains. I walked and I crawled on 6 crooked highways. I've stepped in the middle of 7 sad forests. I've been out in front of a dozen dead oceans. And it's a heart, and it's a heart, and it's a heart, and it's a heart, and it's a heart. Rains are gonna fall.
Sean Wilentz is our guest. What's the story in the book? Was it Allen Ginsberg who heard that song and was just, as you used the phrase, blown away by it?
Yeah. Yes. Allen Ginsberg and his companion, Peter Orlovsky, had been out of America for a couple of years. They had been in India for a while, where Allen was honing his Buddhism. And they came back to America in early 1963. And came back to California, and it was at a party. He describes this in the film No Direction Home that Martin Scorsese made about Dylan. He is at a party at a poet named Charlie Plimel's place in Bolinas, California. And he had missed out. He didn't really know who Bob Dylan was. He'd been in India, and Plimel played this record for him and played that particular song. And Ginsberg has later said that he heard that song and he wept. Because he realized that someone younger had come along to pick up the entire spirit of bohemian or beat illumination that he and his friends had been practicing and writing for actually many, many years. But that someone had come along to do that. He recognized in Dylan a continuity or a continuation of what he was doing, different, but certainly a continuity. And especially at the last, the end of that song, Hard Rain's Gonna Fall, where the singer talks about going out to the mountain and he would know his song well before he starts singing. These are the things that really moved Ginsberg very, very much. So he came to, he left California back for New York, actually, knowing about Bob Dylan and knowing that something special was going on back east.
Did he want to have a relationship with him?
Well... Ginsberg and came back to New York with Peter Orlovsky, and they actually ended up staying in my uncle's apartment.
Oh my, really?
Yeah, because they they didn't have a place to stay. I didn't have an apartment, so they were looking for one, and my uncle let them stay there for a while. It was right at Christmas time, and just after Christmas, the day after Christmas. My uncle threw a party as a kind of way to celebrate the end of the Christmas season, and also as a welcome home for Alan and Peter. And there was a guy in the village named Al Aronowitz who had, entered into kind of Dylan's inner circle and was a reporter, a writer, sort of a hipster himself. And he knew everything that was going on in the village always. So he heard about this party and thought it would be a nice idea to have his friend Bob Dylan meet Allen Ginsberg. So they actually met. The two of them actually met in my uncle's place.
Oh my gosh!
Day after Christmas in 1963, and I don't remember being there. I was probably back home in Brooklyn with my folks, still resting up after Christmas Day. But be that as it may, or I may have been there and just it didn't make any impression on me.
Right.
They talk about poetry. Dylan had hooked up with the Beats when he was out in Minneapolis as a young student for a semester at the University of Minnesota. He and his friend Tony Glover, who was a real hipster guy and a great harmonica player, gotten hip to the Beats. And Dylan's favorite poem of Ginsberg's was Kaddish, not Howl, but Kaddish, the poem about his mother. Dylan invited him to come out to Chicago. He was giving a concert the next day. Ginsberg demurred. But according to Aronowitz, Ginsberg was just coming on to Dylan sexually the entire time, saying that he was, pretty much a framer. And Allen did indeed enjoy sex a lot. But you don't have to have known him to know that. It's right there in the poems.
His sure.
poems are very, very out front about all of that. So there was always this tension between them because, they were there was the older poet and the younger poet.
Mm-hmm.
The younger poet very quickly became a big, big star in a way that no poet, no mere poet could hope to, even though Gregory Corso later great friend of Ginsberg's, part of the Beat Circle, later kind of put down Dylan and the others as just minstrels, whereas you know, they were the poets, they were the courtiers, they were the true artists. But, you know, there was always a certain tension there. But they remained very, very close friends and, you know, comrades, right up to the day that, that Ginsberg died in 1997, the night after which Dylan happened was in Canada, I think in New Brunswick. And he performed. He performed what he said was Ginsberg's favorite Dylan song, which was "Desolation Row," and performed it and dedicated it to Allen Ginsberg.
To Ginsberg, that's quite a story. Your book is filled with these; they're wonderful.
Thank you.
We're speaking this hour with the author of "Bob Dylan in America," Sean Wilentz, is our guest, and we must also tell you that Sean is the historian in residence for Bob Dylan's official website, in addition to being a professor in the American Revolutionary Era at Princeton University, in addition to being the author of The Rise of American Democracy and The Age of Reagan. He's a wonderful guy. If you want to pledge this hour, I hope you do, because this is our very special premium. It's this book for $180, and then you can listen to Dylan and read the book and have yourselves a great experience. So it's just for this hour, and you can pledge at 888-202-2552. This is the Ideas Network.
Ain't it just like the night to play tricks when you're trying to be so quiet? We sit here stranded, though we all do our best to deny it. And Louise holds a handful of rain, tempting you to defy it. Lights flicker from the opposite loft. In this room, the heat pipes just cough. The country music station plays soft, but there's nothing, really nothing to turn off. Just Louise and her lover so entwined.
From the album Blonde on Blonde, Wilentz sees this as the masterpiece of Dylan's most fertile period, 1964 to 1966, Visions of Joanna, the key song on that particular album. Let's go to a phone call, and this will move us nicely into influences, which is a big part of this book as well. John is calling from Eagle River. Sean, hi, John.
Hey, John. Hi, how are you guys?
Good.
What a great hour that you're going to spend on this. Dylan's one of my favorites. A hero. I had the distinction. I lived in Boulder, Colorado for 27 years, and I met who's a poet, Ginsberg. Mm-hmm. I always thought Ginsberg was a fake. But and then I had the distinction of once running a farmhouse to the Unabomber for two months.
Oh, my God.
Wow.
And,
you've got
which,
stories,
yeah. Yeah.
Which was quite an experience. But this was before he moved to Montana. I've always thought Dylan was, you know, like something apart from anything ever we've experienced in this country. And I'm really curious as to who influenced him as he was moving, you know, up through the charts. And then who did he influence in your view during that and later and into the present?
Yeah. Well, you know, lots of people influenced him. I mean, the standard story, which has been told and told well, is how he connected with the music of Woody Guthrie in Minnesota, and he came to New York to find Woody Guthrie, which he did. And Susie Rodolo wrote a wonderful book about the early years in the village. Says he was like a Woody Guthrie jukebox. You know, and that's all he was doing imitations of Woody Guthrie. But, you know, all along, he was listening to all kinds of not only folk music, but pop music, vernacular music of various kinds, commercial pop music, and it was all entering in. He would move very consciously, but he'd move very, that's not the word at all, he'd move very deliberately into one form or another, but he was always moving and he was always taking on other things, so that the entire range of American blues music from the 1920s and 1930s, all those old records of Robert Johnson had a great impact on his work when he was introduced with, by John Hammond in 1962, and he plays, he does, you know, rip-offs of Robert Johnson. But, you know, but then he takes it and he may make something more out of it. So I don't think there's anything, I think that's one of the themes of the book, there's almost nothing in American music, that popular music, that doesn't somehow enter into his work. And indeed, some of the things we think of as American art music, the work of Aaron Copland, there's a whole chapter about this, even though it's not a direct kind of influence, the sensibility that affected that music in the 1930s and the 1940s, the popular front, Americana, using folk songs and raising them to a level of higher art, that kind of idea, that's very much in Dylan's work as well. So those are all influences. Then, in terms of afterwards, you know, who did he influence? I don't think you can look, well, there are some obvious ones, people like Bruce Springsteen, who have said as much, that Dylan kicked open the door to the mind and made it possible for Bruce Springsteen to become Bruce Springsteen, the Bruce Springsteen we know. But I don't think that there's a single singer-songwriter who was not influenced by Bob Dylan in one way or another. I mean, in some ways, you know, Dylan really destroyed single-handedly the old Tin Pan Alley system of producing, you know, commercial songs in this country. I mean, before he came along, and he was part of it too at the beginning, there would be writers who would write songs, and they'd do demo tapes of them. And then agents, producers, would figure out what singer would be best matched to that song. So you had a whole system worked out, sort of like the old Hollywood studio system. Well, Dylan came along and broke all that apart because he not only wrote the songs, he sang them. Now, other people did sing his songs, Peter, Paul, and Mary, Joan Baez, all sorts of other people. But he was always there singing them as well. So he didn't have to have this middleman. He was just out doing them, and it really made for an entire change. And it put the premium on being the person who not only performed the music, but who actually wrote the music.
I was interested, which I didn't know, in Dylan's concerts after 9/11, he would play some, not he would play, but would have music of Copland Rodeo, yeah. I believe, yeah. playing before his concert. Why yeah. did he choose that, do you think,
Sean? You know, well, I don't know. You'd have to ask him, but I mean, it was...
I can't. He's not here.
Yeah, I know. Yeah. I didn't ask him. you know, what happened, yeah, after 9/11, he does his tour, and Dylan always opens his shows with some sort of orchestral overture to sort of alert the audience that the show's about to begin, to alert the musicians, you know, get ready, we're about to hit the stage. Now, actually, he's showing, I gather, scenes from D.W. Griffith's old movie Intolerance.
Really?
Yeah, which is sort of fitting these days, isn't it?
Yeah, interesting.
But just after 9/11, you know, Dylan doesn't talk a lot from stage. He's very reticent. So these overtures can have some sort of meaning, I suppose, attached to them. Well, maybe I'm overreading it a bit, but there's no question that he chose Hoedown from Aaron Copland, which was, and then he opened with a country music song by Fred Rose called Wait for the Light to Shine, which is a song about getting through the hard times, getting through difficulties. Well, you know, Hoedown is a kind of rave-up, if you will, of orchestral rave-up by Aaron Copland. It's about America, but it's also about courage, and it's about enthusiasm. It's about putting down your hoe and going to a dance. Well, that's really what he was trying to impart, but he looked to Aaron Copland to do it.
Yeah. Sean Wilentz is our guest this hour. He's written a wonderful book. If you love Bob Dylan, this is a real treat. Bob Dylan in America. Sean Wilentz is the author, and he heard Sean's story is pretty remarkable as well, but he heard Dylan at the Philharmonic when he was 13 years old, and he's a professor in the American Revolutionary Era at Princeton University. He wrote liner notes for Dylan's album, Bootleg Series, Volume Number 6, and he's the author of a number of books himself. We'll be welcoming more phone calls for Sean, and here's our on-air phone number, 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655 is the number to call. We also are in the middle. Actually, we're a little bit more toward the end of our fall membership drive. Rhonda Fanning is joining me in our studios here in Milwaukee. And we want to tell you that Sean Wilentz's book, Bob Dylan in America, will be yours when you give $180 or more. It only happens this hour because we're only talking to Sean Wilentz this hour. Please make your donation at WPR.org or 888-202-2552. That's 888-202-2552. Hello, Rhonda.
Hi, Kathleen. And when you give at WPR.org or 888-202-2552, you will help pay for the programs that you come to depend on. Our goal this hour was 50 pledges, and we have a ways to go.
We
need 36 more pledges this hour. And what a better hour to pledge at that $180 level. You'll get a copy of Bob Dylan in America, and you'll also be entered in that drawing to win the iPad.
Right. Tell me more about that drawing. People
who pledge at any amount.
Any amount.
They'll be entered. It's only today. You don't have to pledge to be entered. You can also send a postcard with your name and address at iPad Drawing, Wisconsin Public Radio, 821 University Ave, Madison, Wisconsin, and the zip there is 53706.
Great. You can support Wisconsin Public Radio for a song. We're playing songs, actually, this hour. For less money than you're probably spending to download songs from iTunes this year, you can make a huge difference right here at Wisconsin Public Radio. If you download a song a week, you're spending about $52 a year, and that's the first-time donor typical gift to WPR. So please, call with your pledge. Here is the number, 888-202-2552, or you can go to WPR.org.
WPR gives you a window on the world like no other. So please support the exciting mix of programs that you enjoy on this station with your contribution at WPR.org or 888-202-2552. And we're still looking for about another 36 pledges before the end of the hour.
Let's get those in. This is a great hour. Sean's a terrific guest. And we're talking about Dylan, for heaven's sake. So that's great. Bob Dylan in America is the name of the book. And Sean Wilentz is our guest here on the Ideas Network.
I'm out here 1,000 miles from my home, walking a road other men have gone down. I'm seeing a world of people and things. Hear paupers and peasants and princes and kings. Hey, hey, Woody Guthrie, I wrote you a song about a funny old world that's a-coming along.
I love the way he says that. Hey, Woody Guthrie, I wrote you a song. I think you say at one point in the book that Woody was his hero and perhaps his only hero?
Last hero.
His last hero.
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, there's something to having idols, and he was his idol, but then you meet your idol, and you realize that the idol is a person, and that if you're going to go on to do what you want to do, you're going to have to do it on your own. And I think that Dylan's relationship with Guthrie was very much that way. I mean, he only met Guthrie towards the end of Guthrie's life. Guthrie was very ill. He only lasted another 6-7 years or so. But Dylan still remains, you know, very, very close to the legacy of Woody Guthrie. Only last year he appeared on a TV special and sang Do Re Mi, I believe he sang Do Re Mi, an old Guthrie Dust Bowl ballad. So it's still very much in his blood.
Yeah. Please tell me, before we go back to phone calls here, how you got selected to be the historian for his website and also to do these liner notes. Isn't that terrific?
It's amazing. Well, darned if I know. I mean, the fact was, I sort of gotten away from Dylan's music, and then I came back to it for a variety of reasons that are in the book. And I wrote a piece about him in 1998, but then out of the blue came this phone call asking me to write a piece for his website. It was, in effect, going to be liner notes for a new album called Love and Theft. And I said, well, who are you? I didn't quite believe it. But once the person had established his bona fides, I I took on the assignment. I said, look, but only if I like the record. You know, if I don't like the record, I don't want to write anything. So they sent it to me. I loved it. I thought it was great, actually. And I wrote a piece, and they did post it on the website. Actually, it was posted on September 11th, 2001, which is the day that record was released. So it was a very eerie, spooky kind of thing. You know, horrifying thing in many ways, especially given some of the songs on that record. But that began, you know, just a whole series of really beautiful, wonderful friendships in and around Dylan's office and the website and so forth. And in 2003 or 4, I can't recall which, you know, they have a series of, they call it the bootleg series, where they go back and do old concerts, old performances, old tapes that have been lying around, and release them. In a way, to make sure a lot of his stuff has been bootlegged by bootleggers, it's an attempt to try and give proper audiophonically a really good version of these tapes. And then they were doing one on of that concert on Halloween night 1964 at Philharmonic Hall, and you know, they knew that I had written that I had been there, so they said, well, why don't you write the liner notes? And I said, you betcha. So I did. And, you know, it was just kind of complete happenstance. I don't know. Now, the question is, why did they call me originally to do that thing for the website? And who said what to whom and what was going on? And, you know, Kathleen, I've never asked. I just, there are some things in life that I think should just be.
It was just a gift. It was just a gift for you. Oh, I like that, Sean. Let's go to more phone calls. Let's go to... Is it Keith in Appleton? Hi, Keith.
It is Keith in Appleton.
Hi, Keith.
Good morning, Kathleen and Professor.
Hi, Keith.
I saw Bob Dylan at the venerable old Dane County Coliseum in 1976, and I think tickets were about $12, and surprisingly enough, it wasn't a sellout. What was going on was a lot of people were saying, Bob, he's gone electric. We're not going to see him.
Uh-huh.
And other people were saying, we're not going to see him because, well, he's a Christian now. He's just doing Christian music.
Uh-huh.
Well, we went to the concert. His first set was acoustic. His second set was electric. We didn't hear any Christian music. Can you tell us about the extent of which he became immersed in Christianity?
Right. Well, you know, the first point to make is that even though it's not formally thought of as Christian music, there are always biblical themes going all the way back to his very early compositions. Themes of biblical prophecy and biblical parable are always there, even though he's not preaching. In 1979, he had a religious experience, he converted to a particular fellowship out in Southern California. A particular evangelical Christian group, and hung with that for a while thereafter, and on into, so beginning in 1979, but then with three albums really, Slow Train Coming, Saved, and Shot of Love, his Christian beliefs become much more explicit. And in Saved, in fact, he's practically hectoring. He's really preaching himself a Christian message, although some of the songs I went back and listened to are a little bit more complicated than at first I thought. But that's the period where he's, I think of it more of his gospel period rather than his Christian period, because there are Christian themes thereafter, long after this is over with.
Mm-hmm.
But he's appearing on stage. His shows take on the air of a Southern Tent Show revival. He's got his backup singers there. He is preaching. He gives sermons, little sermonettes, to people saying, you're all damned, you're all going to hell, all the rest of it. So that was, you know, took up pretty much the period from 1979 right up to about 1982.
You know, I was glad of it. I was working for another radio station in those days, and one of the jobs they gave me was, you got to do a religious hour on Sunday mornings, and I wasn't particularly religious. And I thought, right, what the heck am I supposed to do? Do whatever you want to do. So I did a music program with the songs that had sort of a spiritual feel. So it was a lot of Peter, Paul, and Mary and Ray Charles. And I was so happy for that album because I could play Dylan all the time every Sunday. And he fit the qualification of you got to do religion to fit FCC requirements.
There you go.
You know?
Well, but there's so much great American religious music. I mean, that's the other thing. That's why I call it.
Oh, yes.
I mean, Elia Jackson.
Oh, love her.
So and going and in, indeed in the book again there's a story about a religious about a hymn the Lone Pilgrim which goes back to the 1830s. So you can't be involved in American music and not have the spirit as well.
Yeah. Sean Wilentz is our guest this hour. He's the author of a wonderful book. It's getting terrific reviews, and it's worthy of every single one of them. Bob Dylan in America is the name of the book, and we're having a terrific hour here talking to Sean and listening to a little bit of Dylan as well on the Ideas Network.
Seen the arrow on the doorpost, saying this land is condemned. All the way from New Orleans to Jerusalem, I travel through East Texas. And I know no one can sing the blues like Blind Willie McDowell.
Blind Willie McTell, you have a lot to say about that song, and it also it captures the genius of Dylan in a way, doesn't it? Because it's Blind Willie McTell who can see what happened in the past, even though he can't see, and he can also see the future. It sort of brings it, the past and the future, and here we are, and we can see both.
Right. Oh, this is Dylan's, one of Dylan's great marks of his genius is that he can collapse the past and the present and make the past feel like the present and the present feel like the past. Like nobody else.
Right.
And Blind Willie McTell, yeah, is I think his greatest song after 1980 or so. And though he's written a lot of other great ones. It's a song that really is a song of the South. It describes Southern history going all the way back to slavery times. It talks about the world as a place of greed and corruptible seed. It's a very hard song, but at the end of each verse, he comes back to the same refrain, which is nobody can sing the blues like Blind Willie McTell, which is, you know, the blues is, it's actually a source of joy in some ways. It's taking your troubles, but then stomping them, taking them and doing something else, and Blind Willie McTell did it in his particular way very powerfully. And so it's really a contemplation about a lot of different things, as Dylan's songs are. But that version that you just played was actually from a session tape that didn't get released at the time. Dylan held on to it for reasons that are still a little obscure to me. It didn't quite come out in his head, so it only came out later on. But I just think it's a masterpiece.
Yes, it is. I'll listen to it all later today. Lee LaCrosse, hi, Lee.
Hi.
Hi. Carry
can
on,
you hear
sir.
Me?
Yes, we can.
Yes,
go
Lee,
ahead.
How are you?
Great. I entered college in 1962, and I always thought Dylan at that time was more a cult than commercial or the genius that he was. I saw him a couple years later. I was really impressed. But what I wanted to ask Sean was about two people, his road manager, Bobby Neuwirth, and his business manager, Albert Grossman.
Right. Well, Bob Neuwirth was a road manager and kind of alter ego. Been out at Oberlin College, had been was on the New York scene, and he was really Bob Dylan's sidekick more than anything else. Around 1964, 65, you know, it's hard to find too many pictures of Dylan out on the town without Bobby Neuwirth being, you know, close to hand. And in the film, Don't Look Back, if those of you have seen the film of his that D.A. Pennybaker made of his of Dylan's London tour, very, very interesting film. There was this other guy also in Ray-Ban Shades that he's always talking to, and that's Bobby Neuwirth. And the two of them would go around. Neuwirth has a wicked sense of humor. And the two of them would kind of pal around. And sometimes they would get kind of rough as they'd put down other people and Phil Oakes in particular got the felt the barbs coming from the two of them. But they were quite a pair for a while on the New York scene. And then he comes back, Bob Newworth does, to perform in the Rolling Thunder Review, and to, he's very much a part of Dylan's world all through those years. Albert Grossman was the great manager of not just Bob Dylan, but of Peter, Paul, and Mary and other folk groups. People think of him as the Colonel Tom Parker of Dylan's story, Colonel Tom Parker, who was Elvis's manager. He's not quite like that, but he was certainly a sharp businessman. He saw Dylan and his other acts as having commercial potential. They oughtn't to be locked up in the ghetto of, kind of self-regarding authenticity that was the folk revival, that they had things that they had music that they wanted, that the world ought to hear and the world wanted to hear. And out of that, he helped make Bob Dylan into the star that he became, the commercial star that he became.
Hmm. Sean, thank you so much for being with us. You're just a pleasure to speak with, and I love the book. And
thank you, Kathleen. That's great.
Yeah, it's just terrific. And I hope you'll join us again. We have a full hour because we have to make money for ourselves here, too.
You go make money. Certainly everybody just call in and pledge away. And I'll speak to you down the line.
Good. Thank you, Sean. I would love that. Sean Wilentz, the book is Bob Dylan in America, and Sean is the author.
I want to rise and I lay on the golden being stolen away. Turn and look in east and west from first in the vine, nothing standing up.
Bob Dylan. That is High Water from Love and Theft, which the author regards as the arrival of Dylan as the eclectic reinterpreter of the full tradition of American folk and popular music. Oh, I hate to let this go. This was really fun, but that's okay. I'm going to listen more this afternoon, should there be time. We are in our fall membership drive. Rhonda Fanning is with me in our downtown studios. Thanks to Chrissy Pease for producing that great hour. I loved it. We got to have that guy back. Today, though, we are an important fall membership drive. We're asking you to put a value on this particular program. And I know many of you are Dylan fans. You will love this Dylan book, such an incredibly important figure in American history, the last century and this century as well. $180, and we'll send you a copy of Sean's book, Bob Dylan in America, as a thank you present. Please, WPR.org or 888-202-2552. Hello, Rhonda.
Hi, Kathleen. We are 30 pledges away from making our goal of 50 pledges this hour, so we still need to hear from 30 of you. Again, at that 180 level, you'll get a copy of Bob Dylan in America by historian Sean Wilentz, and you'll also be entered to the drawing to win the iPad, which is very exciting and another reason to call this hour.
It sure is. Supporting Wisconsin Public Radio is one of the best things you can do today, and it only takes 3 minutes. You can listen to Bob Dylan for 3 minutes, and then you can, well, no, first you need to pledge, and then go listen to a Dylan song. And all you have to do is give us your name, your contact information, how much you would like to give, and how you would like to pay, whether you call or pledge online. We assure you we keep all of your information safe.
Your gift right now will turn into the stories and programs that keep you actually connected to the world. So please give now at WPR.org or call 888-202-2552.
Pledge at WPR.org, as Rhonda said, or 888-202-2552. Maybe your gift is $50 or it's $100. If it's $180, we'll send you Bob Dylan in America. Maybe you will be able to send us $500. Whatever amount you choose, of course, is the right amount. And you can do all this at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
And we're still looking for those 30 pledges this hour to make our 50 pledge goal. Pledges like yours keeps us on track to support the programs that you come to count on WPR. Thanks to all those who have already given. If not, please give now at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
WPR.org or 888-202-2552. And let me just recommend this book once again, because, you know, we pledge books sometimes, and the thing we're talking about, and I know you're going to like this book. If you don't even know very much about Dylan, young people will like this book as well, because he's just a major, probably the major figure in the music scene, the folk scene, the poetry scene of the last 60 years. 60 years! Ooh, where did it go? So it's $180 for a pledge. And you'll get the book, and I know you'll like it. And then go listen to Dylan and make your day.
That's right.
And
did I mention that drawing for the free iPad for anyone who pledges this hour?
I know.
That's also, a pretty cool thing that we have going on.
That
at
is
WPR.
Pretty cool.
So
we are cool.
WPR.org, listening to Dylan, getting iPads. Or 888-202-2552. Thanks, Kathleen.
Thank you, Rhonda, so much. And thanks to Chrissy for producing the hour. Thanks, everybody, for all of your pledges. We'll go out with a little bit of Dylan.